Please help me welcome our speaker tonight, Pat B. from Everybody's Home Group in Media, PA.
Hi, my name is Pat. I'm an alcoholic, recovered alcoholic. And so I say recovered alcoholic usually when I speak because, I have an hour or so to kind of explain, you know, what that looks like and what it means to be a recovered alcoholic. And like I really say that because, you know, when I sat down with my sponsor this time around, the first promise in the foreword to the first edition says, you know, we of Alcoholics Anonymous are 100 men and women who have recovered from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. And by following the directions in the big book and doing what it says and praying when it says pray and all that kind of stuff, I've recovered. And I no longer suffer from, you know, these mental lapses that I would have time and time again that would, you know, me convincing myself that, you know, it was okay to take one drink or, you know, it'll be different this time or, you know, whatever crazy excuse my mind would come up with in light of, like, all the consequences that always, you know, followed me even taking one drink. And I have a sobriety date, which is February 5th, 2015. I have a sponsor. I have the honor and privilege of sponsoring men and women in this program. And I'm just very grateful to be here. And speaking isn't really my favorite thing to do in Alcoholics Anonymous. I'd much rather just sit down with a guy one-on-one and kind of, you know, share my experience, you know, where I was and just, like, kind of guide them through the 12 steps. And for me, like, that has been the thing that really, you know, keeps me going. And like, I've heard so many different things, you know, in different meetings. And for me, like, I can't by myself, you know, kind of like keep it green. Like, I need to work with other guys and see through their experience of, you know, what it was like and you know, really just over time, you know, just grow deeper in my relationship with God. And I came in Alcoholics Anonymous and really the word God really, kind of scared me. And for me, I grew up Catholic. And so I had, like, this skewed view of God. And like, for me, it wasn't like, you know, I hate God or, you know, this fire and brimstone God, but it was just like, what do I really need to do with, like, this thing called God? Like, you know, he doesn't really, does he want something to do with me? I have no idea. But, like, you know, what's the point of even having some type of relationship with God? And this time, you know, they talk about, like, having, like, a first step experience. And I'll get into this in a little more detail later. But just, like, me beaten down to the point where, like, I've gone every avenue that I can, you know, tried every single way, you know, that I knew, to either, you know, be happy or show up, you know, and be a son, be a brother, be an employee, be really anything, that deserves any kind of, you know, respect or, just like trust or like anything that would enable me to be a relationship. Like, without God, you know, I'm not able to be any of those things. And I never thought that was, you know, was going to be the truth. And it was always, you know, me just trying harder or me just, you know, exerting my will more and like time and time again, like it might work or it might like hold up for a little bit, but you know, for some reason or the other, like, and like I never saw that it was me, like, you know, setting this stuff in motion for the bottom to fall out, but the bottom would always fall out. And it wasn't until like this time when I came in Alcoholics Anonymous and like fully submitted and like conceded to my innermost self that I was an alcoholic that like I had absolutely no choice in whether I drink or not, you know, I can't control the amount I take, that I was willing to do the things in order to recover and in order to, you know, be able to show up in all these different ways and be like a trusted member of my family, which for years and years I wasn't. And rightfully so. And like I would always be the guy that would, you know, curse at my parents or you know, not understand why, like, you know, no one trusted me with anything. But like my actions like never led to a person who could be trusted. And so to kind of go through the whole deal and, you know, hopefully, you know, it's in 12 steps, like we carry this message and hopefully like I get to carry this message and not just like Pat's message, but like the message of Alcoholics Anonymous, like 12 steps and a spiritual awakening. And I didn't see the spiritual awakening, but like people in my life saw the spiritual awakening in me long before I did. And you know, I just react differently to life now as a result of, you know, doing this deal. So I'll kind of go through, like, you know, my relationship with God and, like, you know, how I was before and, like, how I am now and, like, what kind of happened and, like, how did I even, like, consider, like, you know, even leaning towards, like, this idea of, like, a power greater than myself or God. And so I grew up in Wallingford, Pennsylvania, which is right by Media. I always say I'm from Media because no one ever heard of Wallingford. If you did, cool. But I grew up in this house with two loving and caring parents who gave absolutely everything, every fiber of their being to provide for me and my younger brother, everything that they didn't have, everything that any child would ever need. And like, I didn't always see it that way. Through like the 12 steps, like I've had this like perception change where, you know, a lot of the things that I thought were the way that they are, like, aren't actually that way. And like I get to go look through my past and look to the future and like be in the present in it. And it would like, you know, kind of like Chuck Chamberlain says, like with a different pair of glasses and just like see the world in a whole new light. And like, I wasn't coming into AA to see the world in a new light. Like, I just wanted to stop drinking and like hurting people. But like the gifts that I've been given from this are like far greater than anything I could have ever imagined. So I grew up in this house and both my parents, my mom just celebrated 30 years of sobriety, on the 7th and my dad's like 32, 33 years sober. And they met in Alcoholics Anonymous and they got sober around the 80s. And like there's a whole story behind that where, you know, my dad's no longer an Alcoholics Anonymous. He's still sober and like one of the best guys. He would, you know, do anything for really anyone. But my mom kind of stuck around in Alcoholics Anonymous and she didn't really go through the steps as outlined in the big book till maybe 6 or so years ago. And I'm like 4 years or so sober. And like just to see the transformation from her going from, you know, meeting attendance just to like having this like awakening is, you know, something that I think helped guide me into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous and like gave like this point of like attraction rather than her. For years it was like, you know, her trying to get, you know, begging me or you know, whatever to go out to Alcoholics Anonymous. But she goes through this process and something happens, something changes. And like all of a sudden, like she's producing this attraction that like wasn't there before. And like by no means was she a bad mother at all, but like she's just a changed person as a result of this process. So I grew up in this household and it's a sober house and my parents try to do, you know, the best that they can. And, you know, we live in Wallingford, which is, you know, I guess upper middle class. And I have a great childhood, but like early on, you know, I can see different things, maybe that, you know, looking back, like point to, you know, maybe signs of alcoholism and like a lot of selfishness, like throughout my childhood, it was always, you know, what am I not getting? It's never like appreciating like what I have or what they've given to me or like how they show up. It was like, you know, what am I not getting? And one good example that I always think of is, so my mom, you know, maybe I was like 8 or 12 years old and my mom throws this birthday party for me at this bowling alley. And so here's like my perspective for like a long time. And then like, I'll tell you like the reality of the situation. So I go into this, birthday party, and it's my birthday party, maybe I'm 8 or 12 or something like that. And you know, she forgets to put me number one on the bowling list. And for somebody like me who all I do from an early age, from as far back as I can remember, like only think about myself and like how I'm being affected, not really looking at other people or what's really going on or like the truth of the situation, you know, I blame my mom. She doesn't love me. She, you know, I'm not good enough. Like I make all these like false narratives in my head that kind of, you know, point me against my mother from an early age. And like that's something I got sober when I was 23 that I would, whenever I wanted something, like I would bring that instance up. You remember when you put me second on the bowling list and you put, I know the guy's name. Exactly. Like Chris, you put Chris ahead of me. I don't think I'll ever forget that. But you put Chris ahead of me, like, you know, like, do you not, I never said, like, do you not love me enough, but, like, that's how I felt. And like, always, like, kind of separating myself. And, like, it wasn't, like, a conscious decision to, like, separate myself, but, you know, I always found something to, you know, kind of put a gap in between me and my next, you know, the person next to me. And like, by no means did I set out to do that, but I think that's just the way that, like, God kind of made me. And like today I get to use like all that like as a benefit and all these experiences that I've had where, you know, I separate myself from others, you know, I get to bring that into, you know, into helping people and kind of help them see that. And so the reality of the situation was, so it's like a 10 or 12 or 8 year old birthday party. There's a bunch of crazy kids running around. They got to get cake. There's a bunch of presents. You know, it's like madness. And my mom like made a mistake and she accidentally put me second and didn't think nothing of it. And, you know, and that's like kind of understandable if you, I mean, I don't have kids, but like, I imagine if you have kids, they're pretty crazy. And, you know, running around, like, birthday party, like, you make one little mistake and, like, your son, like, holds on to that for the next 10 or 15 years. Or at least I would. You know, maybe normal kids wouldn't. But just showing up, and then, like, recently my two grandmothers passed away, and we were looking through all these pictures of, like, my childhood. And, like, I was just, like, a kind of, like, a miserable kid. And, like, every picture that we looked at, like, I didn't have a smile or like, it looked like a super fake smile. And then, like, we would go on, like, these wonderful vacations to California, Florida, you know, all these different places. And, like, you would think I would be, like, the happiest kid in the world. I get to go to Disney World. But we go to Disney World, and, like, you know, I guess my leg hurt a little bit, and I have them, like, pushing me around in a wheelchair the whole time, and just, like, miserable. And then we'll go out to eat, and, like, it won't be exactly the type of food I want. And like, it was always a – if we ever went to a seafood restaurant, I would throw, like, a temper tantrum. And like, the reality of the situation is, like, I could always find something that I like, but I never would because this isn't where I want to be. And so I was just, like, a little terror, and like, I thought that was just, like, normal. And here, you know, along this whole trip is, like, my brother, you know, still to this day, well, really, like, I've been a lot better brother recently as of, like, four years. And, like, that's a relationship that, you know, even 4 years sober, a little over 4 years sober, like, I'm still trying to figure out, like, how to show up as a brother. And, you know, it's kind of cool. We had a heart-to-heart over text a couple of weeks ago, and, like, he told me that he loves me, and we talked about, like, you know, the damage. And like, I made amends to him when I first got sober, but, like, I've gone back since then and, like, kind of check in, like, how am I showing up? And he said something like, you know, first you have to be a friend before you can be a brother. And he was like, you're a really good friend, Pat. And like, that's something that this is coming from a kid who, like, would like, ask my mom and dad, like, begging him, like, why doesn't Pat like me? Like, why does he, like, ignore me? Why doesn't he want to, like, hang out with me? And like I said before, like, I didn't have the capacity to show up as a brother. And like, I wanted to be there for him. And I just, like, couldn't do it. And there's, like, so many different examples of how, like, I just tried so bad to show up. And then other times where, like, I just blatantly ignored him and just, like, wasn't able to show up as a brother. But so another, you know, experience is, yeah, like I said, like, going out to these restaurants and just being absolute terror. And, you know, I would always think of my parents as like, overbearing, controlling, manipulative. And the reality of the situation was that, like, they just wanted what was best for their son. And, like, I in no way, shape, or form knew what that was. And they, you know, they had a way clearer picture than I did of what that was. And like, I just didn't want to hear it. So I would rebel and try to fight my dad and scream at my mom and, you know, just be like this person that, like, I didn't grow up wanting to be. And this is all, like, prior to taking my first drink, you know. And so, like, I don't know, high school comes around and I take this first drink. I can't, like, pinpoint when I took my first drink, but I know that there was this period of time in ninth grade when I would go over to my buddy Joey G's house and we would drink over there, and it was, you know, two blocks away, and I could kind of sneak in the house. And like, another thing was, like, my parents are sober, so it's not like they had, like, a weekend night where they were, like, you know, drunk or whatever. So, like, they were always sober-minded. They always knew when I was up to trouble. My dad has this thing where he falls asleep downstairs in his chair all the time. Just, like, typical, like, you know, dad type of thing. And like, anytime I tried to sneak in, he would always wake up. And he'd always look in my eyes, and he'd be like, I know you're effed up. And I'd be like, nah, I'm not. And then I go on to, like, ramble with him for, like, the next half an hour about, like, something, just repeat myself over and over again. And, like, I thought I was getting away with all this the whole time, and I wasn't. But so I take this first drink, and like, nothing, I don't think, magical happened. But it was just a way for someone who felt disconnected from other people to feel more connected. And it gave me excuses for doing dumb stuff, and it kind of, you know, just made life a little bit easier with, you know, just fitting in the mix of things. So, like, any awkwardness was, like, shooken off, and I don't know, I just kind of fit in. And, like, through high school, like, drinking really wasn't that much of an issue. I mean, I had times where, like, you know, people had to pick me up from the park, like, leaning against, like, some kind of tree or something, like, puking, but, you know, not, I mean, I guess that's maybe a little crazy, but for kids, I don't know. I only have my experience with drinking. I don't know what other people's are, but sometimes I'll tell these stories at work and people like look at me so funny. Like, dude, that's not normal. And so like I go through high school and I get pretty good grades through my parents like pushing me through and I end up, you know, becoming an Eagle Scout and like doing all this like stuff that like outwardly looks good and I go off to college to this place where I had so much more freedom than the house that I was living in. And I can drink the way that I want to drink. And it, like, I don't know that like I can drink the way I want to drink, but like I get to drink like whenever I want, which is kind of cool. And so I start going to classes, and after a while, like I'll miss a class, and like, you know, the big book talks about like driven by, you know, 100 forms of fear, self-delusion, self-pity, you know, you step on the toes, blah, blah, blah. So like I'm like, I could see myself like looking back, like driven by this fear of like what other people think. And so like I'll miss a class. And then I won't go to the next one because I think everyone's thinking about, like, why did Pat miss this class? Why wasn't he there? And I probably just, like, overslept. And, like, that's, like, not that abnormal. But, like, I'm just, like, driven by, like, this idea of, like, what other people think about me. And so, you know, I don't think about all the money that's getting spent or you know, I'm going to fail out of school. But, you know, just, like, what all these other people think. And so after my first semester in college, like, I had a 1.9 GPA, and they said you can come back, but like you have to get better grades. And so I went back home to this sober house, and I'm like in this, you know, drinking thing now, and like I like to drink when I want, like how I want, and like for two parents trying to live in a house that's sober, you know, in their household, you know, by all means it says like in the back, you know, of working with others, like, you know, each family is to choose their own, and like they chose like not to have any alcohol in the house. They still have like the wine from their wedding in like the 80s. And so I came back in this house and I started causing just, you know, pretty bad disruptions, and they know the deal about alcoholism a little bit, and they kind of, you know, pointed it out, and I just denied it. And they would send me to therapists or counselors or, you know, drug and alcohol counselors, whatever. I don't even know what it really was. And I would go and I would lie about, you know, what I was doing. I would never get honest with them because I didn't see like any issue with how I was drinking. You know, I'm a college kid. This is what we do. We party on the weekends and then like some weeknights and then most weeknights. And, you know, sometimes we drink in the day and there's day drinking, you know, then they got like kegs and eggs. So like, you know, you can pretty much like make a reason to drink anytime, like when you're at college. But like when you're in a house that, you know, no one's drinking except for you, it's kind of hard to make different excuses. And they're trying to have some, like, peace and serenity. And I'm disrupting it. And I'm starting to, like, I was a pretty decent kid. You know, I threw those, like I said before, like, those little tantrums and stuff. But, like, I just started lying more. And I just started more, like whatever I needed to do for them not to bother me, to kind of get them out of my hair, you know, I would do. And I would say I was over one person's house because they liked them, and really I'd be over, you know, maybe even a different state. And there were periods where, like, I would go party in New York, and like, I would be like, oh, I'm over my buddy Sean's house. And one day, after, like, a year of saying I was over Sean's house, my parents ran into Sean at the grocery store, and he asked, like, how I'd been. He hadn't seen me in, like, a year, and that was the person I said every single weekend I was going over his house, and so that didn't turn out too well. I'm at my parents' house and I'm living this lifestyle, and I go back to college and I'm expecting to get great grades. Like, I'm a pretty decently smart, you know, I'm not the smartest dude, but like I'm smart enough to get decent grades. And I go back, and the same thing happens again. I'll go to a few classes, then I'm like so feared up and like kind of like hooked into this lifestyle of partying that, like, you know, why even go? You know, and just like kind of thinking, I'm going to get good grades anyway, like even if I don't go. And I didn't. And I recently, I actually just got accepted back to college, and I have a career right now, but, you know, I want to go back to college for something else. And I looked at my transcripts from that year in college, and I would always tell everyone, like, I finished with a 1.9 GPA, and I got like a 1.1, which is like, I think you have to like some effort to get that bad. And so like I moved back home and for the longest time I would say, like, you know, I dropped out of college or like I left college or something like that. But like they asked me, like they sent me like a letter saying like, you're not welcome back here. Like, please do not come back. you can't come back. Like, even if you want to, you're not allowed. And so, I went off to another community college, and I'm living in this house again. And I'm lying more, and I'm manipulating more, and I started hanging out with, I always was hanging out with, the jocks and, the kids that, partied, but, were pretty decent kids. And there was always, that group of bad kids in high school. And so all the kids that didn't go to school or kind of just stayed home, maybe had, a job doing, whatever. I started hanging out with them. And, they drank the same way that I did. And my one buddy, he had an apartment that we could go over to every day. And his mom wanted to get him out of his hair. And so she just, paid for this apartment. And we could do whatever we wanted. And he was the type of friend who would I always had to wear a pair of shorts under my pants so that because if you fell asleep at his house, he would run your pockets. So I would always keep a pair of slider shorts or something under my pants to hide all my money in. But I'm voluntarily going over this person's house to hang out with just because I can do what I want to do and I don't have my parents over my shoulder. And I might spend days at a time there just drinking and just getting deeper and deeper in. And I've been, I could point at all these outside things that kind of make me an alcoholic. And I came in Alcoholics Anonymous my first time and would hear all these outside circumstances. I drink in a corner bar, that's how, or I drink out of a brown paper bag or I live under the L or, I was homeless in Kensington or whatever. And that's what makes me an alcoholic. And I couldn't really identify with any of those things so quickly. I kind of, psyched my way out of Alcoholics Anonymous. And thank God this time around, I had a guy sit down with me and he kind of broke down, what it means to be an alcoholic or, what it means to be, powerless over alcohol. And he talked about the spiritual malady, but he talked about the doctor's opinion. He talked about, this phenomenon of craving, about how, when he takes a drink, he can't control the amount he takes. And I can identify with that. I know that maybe not every single time I drink, maybe there's these sometimes where I can go out and I can have two drinks and then I'll go home and probably do something else too. But, I can pinpoint these times where I can have a couple drinks, but sometimes, I go out to have a couple drinks and I just overshoot the mark and maybe I'll have an important engagement to make the next day, work. So many times, work's kind of important. And so many times, my mom would, I'd be up all night drinking and my mom would drive me to work the next day. And I would be, I don't know how I did. I ended up getting fired from that job, but, I don't know how I didn't get fired on the spot or the police called on me. But when I take this drink, I don't know what's going to happen. And my experience, abundantly confirms that every time I drink or put whatever in my body, something happens that doesn't happen to my younger brother. And that sets me apart. And I could get down with that because there's so many outside circumstances that I can't identify with. And maybe some of the outside circumstances that, I'll describe tonight, maybe you can't really get down with. But, when you take a drink, does something happen? Do you want more? And then the strange thing is when I do get sober, they talk about this mental obsession, for some reason, my mind always shrinks me into thinking it wasn't that bad. You total three cars, you've been in 14 different car accidents, all as a direct result of drinking. That won't happen again. Just take a first drink. Or, it wasn't that bad. You didn't completely tear your family apart. You just have one or you'll just have a few. That's it. And it'll come at me in a million different ways. And sometimes I'll know when it's going to happen and sometimes I won't. And it'll just the big book uses that word suddenly. And suddenly it'll come out of nowhere and I'm hijacked. And next thing I know, I'm drinking. And then once I drink, I can't really stop. I'm the type of dude that I'm so scared of what other people think that I can't ask for help. And something has to happen in order for me, to even seek some type of help or even think that I have some kind of problem. And then they talk about spiritual malady in a vague way where for me it's I feel super uncomfortable with my skin and I know I'll get that ease and comfort from taking a few drinks and then it says in the doctor's opinion, it happens over and over again because once I do take those drinks to get the ease and comfort, all bets are off. And family, I always thought because I'm going over to my friend's house and doing this, and I'm not doing it in my family's house, that they weren't really being affected. And behind closed doors, there were many fights. And just like that instance with my mom, you know, meeting my friend Sean at the grocery store, there were so many times when my parents got asked, like, how's Pat doing? And, like, they had to, like, blatantly lie and say either, you know, he's doing good, which is clearly a lie, or they have to lie and, you know, say, you know, make up some story. And, like, that's no position to put a parent in. And it wasn't until, like, I went through the 12 steps and kind of looked at that stuff with my, you know, a good sponsor, and he pointed out these things, which, like, I never even thought were the case, and they absolutely were. And so what happens was I'm hanging out over that dude's house, and I'm going to my dad used to go pull me out of the bar. It was kind of crazy. But I would go to this place up by my house. I would drive up there, obviously, which is never drinking it. I don't condone drinking and driving, but, you know, who doesn't do it, I guess. But I would go up to this place, and I would pick up, like, a six-pack of Pounders after I'm done drinking the night, and then I would come back home, and I would drink them. And it was, like, 4 o'clock in the morning, and at this point, it's, like, 2012, and I know, like, every sound that the house makes. Like, I know what stair to step on. I know the sound that my dad makes when he's, like, about to wake up. I know exactly how to, like, be a ninja around the house. And then I know what time my mom wakes up, and she wakes up super early. I know what time she goes to bed, so I can time it perfectly, and I know when she goes out to smoke, so I can time it perfectly, so I don't have to see her when I leave in the morning, because I know that the sound that the back door makes when she goes out to smoke, and then I know what time she's going to be in bed. And nine times out of ten, my dad he's usually passed out on the couch or on his chair, whatever. He loves sleeping. I love sleeping too, but he's not like drunk passed out. He's like passed out like whatever. Maybe with, like, a chip on his stomach or something. Yeah, it's funny. Not like an AA chip, like a potato chip. And so, like, it's 4 o'clock in the morning, and I know that my mom's about to wake up in an hour, and I don't have any more cigarettes, so I need to go to Lukoil to grab more cigarettes. And I take my dad's truck, and he absolutely loved this truck, and I would forever say it was my truck, and I put this truck through hell. And, oh my gosh, it was like his baby, and it's still driving around somewhere. We see it every now and then, and it's just, like, beat the hell up. And all from me. He like, never crashed it once. And so, like, I don't know, like, if you don't fully turn the gas, that you don't have power steering or power brakes. So I'm trying to back out of my driveway, and I get stuck in the grass, and then, like, I hit a tree at the bottom of my driveway, and I'm, like, I'm trying to be quiet in the meantime, and I'm, like, squealing tires. I have to get a piece of wood and, like, shove it under the tire, and I eventually get out. The side yard's all turfed up. There's a big gash, and he's, like, loves, like, outdoors and, like, planting trees and, like, planting flowers and all that kind of stuff, and he has, like, this Japanese maple, or, like, red Japanese maple that he planted at the bottom, and, like, he loves this thing, and it's still got the mark into it. It still lived, and it still has the mark in it, and sometimes I look at it, I'm like, oh, my gosh. And so I hit it, and I go and get my cigarettes, and I come back, and my parents are on the back deck waiting for me. And if your parents are ever on the back deck at, like, 4 in the morning, it's usually not – for me, it's never a good thing. And so I go out there, and they kind of have an idea of what I'm doing up to this point. And the easiest way to get out of a situation like this, and they're like, you know, we think that you should go to, you know, rehab. And I said, okay. Because if I go to rehab, then it'll kind of smooth over this situation. I can get them off my back. Maybe sobriety isn't the worst thing, you know, that could happen. You know, I still have a lot of, you know, reservations. But I end up going to treatment. And I go to this place. And earlier I kind of talked about, like, feeling, like, disconnected or putting up, like, this, you know, almost wall between people or just, like, forming some type of disconnect. And, like, I never felt quite, you know, like, I connected with people, and like, through the 12 steps and through a relationship with God, like, that's how I feel connected to people nowadays. Like, for me, I don't connect. If I connect with you, that's not, like, not how I usually connect with God. It usually comes from, like, me connecting with God, like, I'm able to connect with you. And so I go to this treatment center, and I don't want to go, and I'm crying because I'm scared, and it's, I've never been there before. And something happens, like, 3 or 4 days in, where I look up at the sky and I feel like this overwhelming feeling that like I'm connected to someone. And I never felt that feeling my entire life. And I just had like this picture of like the people of the world and me just like being a part of them. And like I never felt that way before. And if you look at my past up to that point, like outwardly, like I had a ton of friends. Like I always, you know, hung out with all different groups. I got along with, you know, mostly anyone. But like something on the inside just felt kind of disconnected. And so I go through treatment and insurance ends up cutting me short. I was there for like 7 days and I get out and they say like you'll have a higher success rate if you go to a meeting your first day out. So my parents pick me up and I'm like crying because I don't want to leave because like I feel like this is where I should be. And we go to this meeting and it's like canceled. And like that's kind of, it was like foreshadowing for like my whole stint in AA that time. And so I go to AA just because my parents want me to. And I had this idea. My parents bought me a PS3 and I got these games and I would just hang out in my room and play PS3. I don't even really like video games. Like I'm like PlayStation 2 and lower. Like I don't have any like the new ones. I don't even know how to like play them. They're like crazy. But I got this PS3 and like that was my thing. I would stay in my room. I would just avoid all these different places and, you know, I would stay sober. And it didn't exactly work out, but I came to Alcoholics Anonymous and that stint in sobriety, I probably collected up to 7 months of coins. At no point during that did I have more than like a month sober. But I would get these coins and I would bring them home to my parents and like they would think that they're getting their son back slowly but surely. And they weren't. And I got a sponsor just because one of my high school friends got sober and he had a sponsor and we were, his car like broke down and that sponsor came over to help us. And we were all in the car together and I heard get a sponsor. So like I asked this dude who was my buddy's sponsor and like, thank God, like I asked him because this was a dude that was like armed with the facts about himself and like was, you know, had a, you know, a firm understanding of the 12 steps and the big book. And I had no idea what any of that meant. Or any idea like what I was supposed to be looking for. It just so happened that my buddy's car broke down and his sponsor came to get him and that was it. And like, thank God. And so I go to meetings and I start going through some step work and I'm not honest with them. And, you know, I don't concede to my innermost self that I'm an alcoholic. You know, maybe I have some of the traits, but you know, maybe I can drink someday. And so I have this like lurking notion, that, you know, one day I can control and enjoy my drinking and I can't. And so I go through some steps. I, you know, I did a fourth and fifth step, you know, whatever. And I came to Alcoholics Anonymous and I went to meetings and I collected coins and outwardly, like it seemed like I was doing pretty good, but I just felt overwhelmed with anxiety and all these, like they talk about restless, irritable and discontent. And I don't know, like if I would use those words, but you know, similar words to that is what I was experiencing. And I, you know, I didn't really get any relief because I didn't like fully submit myself to the program. And I don't think that I had a strong enough, you know, experience where like I felt defeated enough where I was willing to do what it takes to recover. And so slowly but surely I weaned myself out of Alcoholics Anonymous. And like 2 years goes by of me drinking and by no means was, you know, maybe three quarters of that I had good times, but the bad times were so bad. And to kind of fast forward to my last month, you know, I had like everything and outwardly, I always thought my idea was, you know, kind of like they talk, you know, on 60 to 63, like this actor trying to arrange a play. And, you know, I thought if I could just get all these things in line, like life would be great. And that like this hole that I didn't know, even know that I had inside of me would fill up. And I had a brand new car. I had a house that I was renting. I had a girlfriend. I had a career. I still have that same career by some miracle. Yeah, that's just a miracle too. But I, you know, I had all these things and I still felt so empty. And I had this girlfriend whose parents called an intervention for her. And I was, you know, not a really good influence on her life at all. And I was drinking just how she was. I was getting her alcohol. And they called me for an intervention for her. And like, I was probably the one who needed the intervention. And this is like 2 weeks before I got sober. And like, I had to go into this thing and like, tell her what she needed to do with her life. And it was like the most, I've never felt more bad in my entire life. I had this knot in my stomach for like a week and a half that I just, no matter how much I drink, just wouldn't go away. And so like liquors, you know, kind of stopped working. And no matter what I, you know, materialistic things, you know, outside, you know, issues or whatever you want to call them, whatever I threw in myself, none of it would kind of, you know, make me feel okay. And like that kind of sucks when that happens. And, but I'm like too scared to ask anyone for help and I don't know what to do. And, you know, I'm thinking that if I just keep this girl at my house where I'm drinking all the time that, you know, she'll get sober and, you know, maybe I'll take her, I took her to a couple of treatment centers. You know, maybe we stopped at the casino on the way there. That's not usually what, I wouldn't recommend that. It was bad. I got like 3 Wawa large coffees and spilled all 3 like within an hour in the car, in this brand new car that I had. And I got so frustrated. I used to get so frustrated over like the smallest little thing. And like now, like it's crazy to look back and like see what would frustrate me. And just like this relationship that I formed with God puts me in a position where if I'm doing the work, in that day, then, you know, a lot of stuff doesn't really bother me that I used to look back and it would bother me so easily. And one of the coolest things about sponsoring guys, I think, is seeing the problems early on that have such a big effect on them. And then, like, as they grow spiritually and start to help other people, like, these things that used to bug the, you know what out of them, you know, don't really affect them. And like, just to, like, step back. Because I can't always see it in myself, but I could always see it in another person or a guy or girl that I'm working with. And so what happens? So I always do these things to, like, and they talk about this in the book, too. Like, he may be quite virtuous. You know, some alcoholics have very treats. So my deal, I would be mean if I needed to be, but, like, my thing was usually, I'll be really nice to you so you give me what I want. And maybe, you know, I won't be, like, an ass, you know? And so, I go over to my grandmother's house. So I can get $20 and borrow a car. But really, like, I'm going over to put her Christmas decorations away so I look like a good grandson. But, like, you know, my motive was to get something out of her, not just to do it because she's my grandmom and I love her, and, like, that's what a grandson should do. And so I go over there and I borrow her car, and I go to this parking lot, and I'm drinking, and, you know, I look around, and there's no one there, and I'm drinking in her car, and, out of nowhere, this cop pokes up to the window, and he's knocking on the window. And I try to, like, hide the bottle in between my legs, and I got another bottle on the passenger side. And he's like, "What are you doing?" And I'm like, "Oh, I'm not doing anything." And he's like, "Dude, I'm not an idiot. Like, this is my job." And so he, like, catches me, like, drinking in my car. And I had a whole bunch of paraphernalia in there as well. And he pulls me out, and I'm like, I'm an alcoholic, like, thinking he's going to, like, take my, you know, drinks and just, like, kind of like, "Oh, okay, just hit a meeting." And it doesn't work that way. And so I go to the precinct, and, you know, I've seen in movies before, if you're crazy, then they, like, kind of let you off with some kind of, like, insanity or whatever. So I'm in this police station, like, hitting myself on the head, like, screaming to myself, like, trying to look like I'm, like, bipolar or psychotic or, you know, something. And they're like, "Dude, like, stop. Like, we know you don't have any issues. Like, you just look like an idiot." And so,
oh my God.
Yeah. And so, like, I go in the holding cell, and I've been in holding cells before, and then I usually go home the next morning, and that's not what happened. I got arraigned, and then I went to George W. Hill. And at that point, I felt probably the lowest that I've ever felt, and I felt I was never going to amount to anything, that my life was a complete failure. That career I had was, you know, I was going to lose. I would have a record. Not that I didn't have a little bit of a record before, but, you know, I would never amount to anything, and I felt completely broken. And in this spot where, you know, I was just kind of given this gift where I was willing to, like, fully believe that, you know, something needed to happen. And I go into jail, and maybe, like, 3 days in, maybe, like, 2 days in, I'm reading this little, like, Daily Bread thing, and I like, shoot up a prayer, because, like, I learned a few things in Alcoholics Anonymous before, and I said, "God, I can't do this anymore. Please help me." And I took a little nap, and I woke up, and I stood up on this little stool, and this was around, February 1st, 2015, and I look out the window and it's snowing, and it's like I've never seen it snow before. And it was like I was given, like, I don't even know how to, I can't, like, words can't describe, like, what happened. And, like, I was just changed. And this is even before the 12th step, but, like, God changed, like, my view. And he, like, I wasn't able to, like, lie. Like, I've lied since then, don't get me wrong. But, like, I wasn't able to lie for a while. And I was telling my parents all type of stuff that, like, I probably shouldn't have told them. But I just, like, couldn't lie about anything. And, like, I just had this experience where, like, I felt, like, an overwhelming feeling that I was going to be all right. And I told my parents that, and, like, they didn't believe me, which I don't blame them. Because, like, nothing that led up to that would give them any reason to believe anything that I said. But I was always like, yeah, I'm going to be all right, I know. Like, I had this overwhelming feeling that I knew that I was going to be okay. And turns out, up to this point, like, I've been pretty okay. And so I get out under this agreement that I don't move back to my apartment, and I go to treatment. So I go to treatment, and I call that old sponsor that I had. And he came on a Saturday so he could come visit me on a Sunday. And, like, you know, just to start off, that shows, like, you know, why is this guy that, you know, I've pretty much thrown through the mud. He's seen me good and bad. He takes 2 days out of his weekend, which, like, weekends at that point were, like, you know, I mean, I wouldn't give anyone a weekend, not even, you know, whoever. And he comes in, and we start going through the steps, and he took me through 1 through 3 and a little half an hour sit down and gave me a 4-step to write, which I wrote in a few days in treatment. And I ended up going through treatment, and I told my parents I was willing to go to any lengths, and they said I wasn't welcome back at their house. And I was disappointed, but I ended up going to this recovery house and kind of getting hooked in with this recovery community there. And it helped me introduce me to the fellowship and just a place to kind of, like, a shelter where I could get through the rest of the work. And so I ended up going through the rest of the 12 steps in a pretty short amount of time. And around 3 months sober, he sent me out to sponsor guys. And really, in that aspect, I haven't really looked back. But so I got out of treatment, and there were these voicemails on my parents' answering machine and from the Westchester Police Department. And like, that's not where I got arrested from when I went to jail the first time. And there were warrants out for my arrest. And so, I'm through some of my steps, and, like, I'm starting to experience this relationship with God. And I go in, and I turn myself in, and I'm facing all these charges, something that I didn't even know that I did. But I definitely did do it. yeah, and I go in, and I, you know, my prayers, if I ever do pray up to this point, are, you know, God, give me this, or God, give me that. And I just ask God, I say, God, just please, you know, give me strength and courage to get through whatever you have for me. And like, that was such, like, a radical change in my prayer life, to where, you know, I'm not demanding something from God, but I'm just asking for him to, like, guide me through this situation, which I really have no control over, you know, what it is. And so I go through this long court process, and I'm sponsoring guys and you know, kind of doing the deal. And, like, you know, I'm starting to grow with God. And like, I was so blessed that when I got sober, I was surrounded by this group of men who, like, were just doing the deal and just on fire for AA. And like, they used to, like, I was scared to, like, be wrong, kind of. And like, they would ask, like, you know, what does it mean to be powerless over alcoholism? Or, like, what does it mean? What's, like, a big book definition of an alcoholic? And so I would go home and, like, study up. So, like, if I ever got asked that question, I wouldn't get it wrong. But, like, it kind of drove me into, like, learning more. And, you know, I would be the dude that would be sitting on the couch in the recovery house, like, reading the big book, and just, like, God gave me this overwhelming, you know, enthusiasm for recovery that like, I couldn't muster on my own the first time around. And so I go through this court process, and about 8 months over, I have to go into jail. And like, I get to go, like, as a free man and with a smile on my face, and, like, a deep, like, knowing that, like, this is the place that God wants me to be, and that he's going to use me. And like, I've found that wherever God takes me, you know, he has some kind of intent for me, someone to help, some way to be used, some message to carry. And that was so true in the jail. And I spent nine months in there between, like, month 8 and, you know, whatever plus 9 months is. So I guess month 17. And I celebrated a year sobriety in jail, and I was free in there. And I got to start this big book study on Sunday nights. And we went through the whole big book line by line. And just to see, at one point we had, like, 15 people which like is crazy. And the first person I ever took through all 12 steps was in a jail cell, and to see somebody's eyes kind of light up like behind bars is, I don't know, it was just such a cool experience. And I'd be on this phone, I'd be waiting in this line for to get on the phone, like calling, you know, all these different guys from my group to, like, you know, what do I say here? Like, because I've never taken anyone all the way. Like, it'd be like 1, 2, 3, and then I never hear from them. And so I get into jail, and, you know, I'm getting them through these steps. And, you know, I'd just be calling them and, like, what do I do here? Like, how do I do this fifth step? What do I tell them here? What page? And it was just so cool, and I got to go in there and you know, just experience God in a different way, and really it gave me this sense that, like, I don't really need much in life. Like, you know, when you're in jail, if anyone's ever been there, you don't have much. Like, I got a nice sack of food every week, but, like, other than that, like, I had my little area, and that was pretty much it. Like, I didn't have all these materialistic things, and I got to be at perfect peace and ease, and like, I never really experienced that, you know, with nothing. And I, like I said before, I always thought it was, if I arrange all these outside things, that I'd be okay. And here I am, like, with very little to nothing and a relationship with God, and, like, I'm perfectly content and happy at that. In a place where, like, it's not a very spiritual place in jail, and just be, like, to be able to be something different in a place that, you know, not many people are doing that was so cool. And so I got out of there, and I came back to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I did the things that I was taught to do, and I showed back up, and I was, you know, in the 11th step, it says, like, see where religious people are right, and, like, through this process, like, I saw it so many different ways, and you know, the avenue that I ended up getting led into through various people and, like, very intense seeking was I got plugged in with this church, in my neighborhood, as it was actually the same place that my my first home group was in, and like, just to see God come out in that way, and like, I've grown, oh my God, I've grown so much, and like, I get to teach these kids Sunday, I teach Sunday school, which is, like, absolutely insane, and like, these little kids know more about, like, the Bible than I do, and like, I learn way more from them than they do from me, and I lead this study on Tuesday nights, And I, you know, I've gotten called into so many different areas where, like, I'm able to serve God. And you know, I never thought when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous that, like, that would be the avenue. I wanted nothing to do with church. But just being open to, like, wherever God take me and just, like, not have an idea of, like, what it should look like kind of brought me to the position that I'm in now. And like I said before, you know, sponsoring guys is one of my absolute favorite things, and like, I've seen so many, and like, I've been able to sit down with women too, and just, like, oh my God, it's so much different, and just to see, you know, a different perspective, and just, you know, but at the end of the day, it's like one alcoholic sitting down with another, and you know, just to see these lives change, and like, sons, you know, grow their relationship with their parents, or fathers or mothers, you know, get back in their kids' lives. Like, that's something that, like, I would miss if I wasn't doing that. And so I got this new sponsor a few years, maybe like a year and a half ago. And like, when I was early in recovery, I was doing nightly inventories, maybe for 3 months, and then I stopped, and I would do a 10-step every once in a while. And recently I've been through all 12 steps again, but I, with somebody who's not my sponsor, but I got this sponsor who's all about, like, 10 and 11. And so maybe for, like, the last, like, 16 months, every night, like, I do a nightly inventory, and it talks about, like, growing and understanding and effectiveness. And, like, I've, you know, seen, you know, my effectiveness in every area of my life grow from, like, daily inventory and looking at it. And most importantly for me, it says, you know, it says at the end of, like, the nightly inventory, it says, like, we ask God for forgiveness and what corrective measures can be taken. And I could easily just go and, like, say that and then just, like, go to bed or you know, go about what I'm doing. But, like, to actually sit and, like, wait for God to, like, give me some instruction of, like, what can actually be done. And does God talk to me every single time? No. But like, there's been, like, some big areas in my life where, like, you know, God has spoken to me and said, like you shouldn't, you know, maybe not in these exact words, but, like, I get a feeling or like, an intuitive thought where, like, you shouldn't be here or you shouldn't be doing this, or this is, you know, what direction you can take. And one of the most interesting things, I think, is, you know, it says, like, what used to be occasional hunch or inspiration, you know, becomes a working part of the mind. So like I go through the steps and I live this on a daily basis, and I go from this mind that I could never rely on to this thing where, like, you know, on a daily basis, like I get to rely on my intuition or rely on like this God consciousness that has developed through a lot of work, and just like repetition and, you know, just like doing it day in and day out. And like, you know, every time is it inspired? No, but like more and more I see as I grow with God, like, I can rely on, you know, the thoughts that come up. And that's something that, like, I always heard, like, you can never, you know, your first thought is always a bad one. But, like, you know, the book is pretty clear that, like, if after time you continue to do this stuff, like your mind changes. And most importantly for me, I'll kind of end with this, and it's no crazy story or anything, but, like, today, like, I'm able to show up, like, in for my family. And like, the family that would love me no matter what I did to them, you know, how I acted, where, you know, how many crimes I committed, even if, you know, I murdered someone, they would still love me to death. You know, I get to show up in a capacity that I was never able to do. And you know, like I talked about my brother earlier, like we're forming this relationship, and by no means is it where, you know, I would like it to be, or probably, you know, where it's going, but it's day by day, you know, going in the right direction. And my family's going on vacation. This, like, my mom and dad are going to a wedding in Dominican Republic or something this week, and like they trust me enough to take care of the house, like water the flowers, like take care of the dog, you know, all this little stuff. I couldn't be trusted with the littlest thing. Like I would kill that plant, like the dog. I probably wouldn't kill the dog, hopefully, but like these things wouldn't happen. And like it's these little blessings that seem like such little things, but like in reality of like where I've come from are like such big things. And for me to show up and do the little things day in, day out, like whether it's like hang up the little towel in the bathroom that when you step up, you know, or like bring up the trash. Like, these are like the little things that matter to my parents. And like, I never thought like the little stuff mattered. And like, I get to show up in big ways too. And like, you know, my parents feel like they're proud of me. And like, that's something that I always wanted. And I always strive for, but I always fall short of. And like today, like as a result of the 12 steps and this relationship that I form with God, like I'm able to show up, you know, as a man of integrity and for somebody to be proud of and as an employee. And it's just amazing. And I'm so grateful for Alcoholics Anonymous, and I guess that's all I got.